Board of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open session for citizen adjournment.
Good morning. Be seated, please. First case in our calendar is 96-1956, State of Ohio versus Lawrence Reynolds, Jr. Mr. Whitney.
Mrs. Green and myself came down from Akron, hopefully to point out what we think to be some of the important issues, at least to you. The first issue has to do with Proposition Law 1 and the ineffective assistance claim outlined in that proposition. What I'd like to address is the appointment of lead counsel some 2 weeks prior to trial. What happened in this case, Your Honors, is that 2 weeks before the trial began, Judge Snyderman, the Court of Common Pleas in Summit County, realized that the lead counsel was not certified by the rules of certification, and then appointed another counsel, Carrie Ryan, to represent this defendant. The case proceeded to trial within 2 weeks. The first phase merits were heard, and then 2 weeks subsequent to that, the penalty phase. So within a month, the whole trial was completed with representation of Mr. O'Brien being the lead counsel. That is what's in the record regarding issue number one. Both Mrs. Green and myself are cognizant of our burden under Strickland to demonstrate prejudice in this case, and I, in an effort to do that, over the last couple of days, reread the transcript that I haven't read in about a year. And I did find that Mr. O'Brien participated in the trial. Mr. O'Brien objected occasionally. Mr. O'Brien made argument to the court regarding legal issues. So I'm not here to say that he did absolutely nothing during the course of the trial. And I'm not here to say that per se, this is some violation of the Strickland standard. But I think in these kinds of cases, when I heard it as a lawyer practicing law for 24 years in the courtrooms around here, when I heard this, I was appalled. Personally, I was embarrassed as a lawyer. I was appalled that any lawyer would take a capital murder case 2 weeks prior to trial, and then somehow we work our way through the system and find that we have a burden of proof, at least from a defendant's point of view. There are so many things that a capital murder trial have, especially in a case like this that was basically a penalty phase trial, from what I can see.
Is it your contention that, I mean, the case had been prepared, obviously, and is it your contention that Mr. O'Brien would have done other investigation or would have done things in preparing for trial that he wasn't able to do, or that he just simply didn't have time to sort of absorb the record?
That's part of it, Judge. Not only to absorb the record, but to absorb the defendant that you need in these kinds of cases, a time to be with the defendant in a time when he's on trial for his life. Hi, I'm Larry Whitney. I'm your new counsel. We're going to go to trial next Monday. I mean, that's the way it was. And then we're going to present evidence in a couple of weeks to hopefully convince the jury that we're going to save your life. And by the way, you spell my name, W-H-I-T-N-E-Y. I mean, that's literally the way it was in this case. And I think it just impinges upon the integrity of our system to permit this to happen. And I look through the record. First of all, Mr. O'Brien was not present in any pretrial motions. He was not present in the pretrial strategy regarding how to try a very difficult case like this, where you have evidence of the defendants. You have evidence from the defendant's own brother that my brother took me to the scene. You have evidence from two of the defendant's friends that say that he told me that he killed this woman. You have evidence seized from the defendant's own bedroom. So you have a very, very, the most difficult of capital cases from a lawyer's point of view to try. In terms of trying to figure out how to do this case, Mr. O'Brien was not present during all of those pre-trial, if you will, strategies.
Well, but from what you have just described, skill and experienced counsel wouldn't take too long to figure out you're under the penalty phase. There really is no hope here, and all of what you've just described is preliminary puttering around in this case. It's going to get you nowhere.
There's always hope. There's always something you can do. And I was thinking that when Mr. Green is kind enough to drive me down here this morning, that what would I have done in 2 weeks? But I have prepared for this trial. I've had any number of these. I've been trying cases for 20 since 1974. So could I have done this? I probably could have done this.
Yeah, but would it really depend in this case on how much had been developed, how many leads had been run down with respect to mitigation?
Sure.
What kind of a file you had at that point?
And maybe those things are better served in a post-conviction situation than in this court, from where we're looking at basically the record of this case. But I guess what I'm saying is that what bothers me as a lawyer, and that is very much concerned about the integrity of our own system, is when we permit this to happen, why did the judge just continue the trial? I mean, why are we so concerned? I mean, this is something that somebody made a mistake. The guy wasn't, George Keith was not certified, or he didn't indicate to the court that he lacked the certification. Something happened. They could have been easily corrected by, we'll try this in August rather than in July. I mean, particularly now, when with the argument we got before was when we had the special plenary for jurors, that we had all the county expenses conjuring up these extra 175 people. Now we don't. Now we take our jurors right from the normal panel. So that is not an argument. The administration kind of arguments are no longer as valid as they were before. But that's what upsets me, just as a, and I know the burden here, and I'm not trying to say this court will look at this record and find that he did nothing. That's not true. He did not. There were motions filed, probably, as I can see it, appropriate motions filed before he even entered the case. He did object. He did argue. But I just, it just bothers me tremendously.
Well, doesn't this record, if we were to follow your, agree with your argument, doesn't this record then put us in the position of saying to the trial judge that even though you have questioned the new lawyer extensively and the new lawyer says, I can do it, that the judge has to say, in effect, no, you can't, or at least for appearance's sake, I'm going to say, you cannot. I'm going to give you more time. I think it would be different if the lawyer kind of dropped into the case and no one knew he hadn't been given a chance to demonstrate to the trial judge that he could pick up his role in the case at that point. What do we say? How would we write the law on this issue?
That's a very good question, Your Honor, because I could probably try an angry burglary case Thursday morning. And I'm not saying that I couldn't try this case within 2 weeks, but just getting prepared to try a capital murder case or a burglary case, there's more to it, particularly in capital murder cases, than just the preparation of the evidence, reviewing the evidence.
Well, sure, yeah, I've given all that, but here's the lawyer who's a Rule 65 lawyer, and he says to the court after extensive questioning, I can do it, I'm ready. I mean, he knows enough to ask for a continuance if he thinks he needs one, doesn't he? I mean, what the trial judge has to say to him, in effect, well, you're ready, but we're going to continue it anyway. Is that's really what you're
what
saying?
I'm saying, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know how you get around that other than the interests of the society as a whole in the integrity of the system sometimes outweigh those kinds of things.
Well, that the court has, I think your argument is that ultimately the judge has responsibility for being sure that the trial is performed according to all of our rules and law, and that even if the lawyer says I'm ready, the trial judge has the ultimate responsibility to be sure that there isn't some defect here that...
Right, I think that's what I was trying to say. Issue number two is in proposition of law two, having to do with the search of the defendant's room. This defendant lived with his parents. He was 27, 28 years old, lived with his parents, had a room. He was arrested about 6:45 in the morning, taken out, put in a cruiser. The police were all around the house, searching the house. They got consent to search the whole house from the father. Well, something special, a light went off with one of the high-law, I think, at the scene, because they cordoned off the defendant's room. There's no evidence in the record, for instance, about whether the room was locked or unlocked. The state says that it's brief that it was locked. Maybe it was, but I didn't find that in the record. But they cordoned off the defendant's in this room for some reason, searched the rest of the house. The defendant's sitting in a cruiser out in the parking, out in the driveway, at least for 20 or 30 minutes while the search is going on. The police then decide to get a consent to search from the defendant's father so that they can enter the room. They thought that was necessary. In addition to that, they thought something else was cooking because they decided later on in the day, after they searched the room and found, wrote the check, the victim's check, and rope and cord and gloves and blood and all kinds of trace evidence over all this stuff, that that they ought to talk to the father in more detail about whether there was any common authority over that room. So they interviewed the father subsequent to the search. And the evidence is, I think, at least from the record as I can see it, is that the door was not locked, that the defendant did in fact rent a room from his father, but had not paid rent for 3 or 4 months because he was unemployed. And that's really basically what the evidence is regarding the facts surrounding the search. And I have cited, or we have cited in our brief, a Ninth District case, I believe it's State versus Williams. And common authority is not to be applied to the mere property interest. Basically, it rests on the mutual use of the property by persons generally having joint access or control. And I don't know, I just wish the record had more in it regarding this room and regarding whether it was locked, regarding the testimony of the defense, but it doesn't. And that's really all the evidence we have regarding whether or not this consent of the search a room belonging to, or at least occupied by the defendant, but owned by the defendant's father, was proper. In Proposition Law Number 7, we have an issue regarding an acquittal first jury charge, State versus Thomas issue. If you read the records, what the judge says in this case, and I personally have always tried to get judges to charge juries the way Thomas tells us they ought to be charged. And the holding of Thomas that a jury must unanimously agree that the defendant is guilty of a particular criminal offense before returning a verdict of guilty on that offense. If a jury is unable to agree unanimously that a defendant is guilty of a particular offense, they may proceed to consider a lesser included offense upon which evidence has been presented. The jury is not required to determine unanimously that the defendant is not guilty of the crime charge before they may consider a lesser included offense. I don't know why I've always tried to get judges to charge, to just fill in a couple of holes here, and you have it very clear. This case is kind of a borderline case, somewhere in between, I think, Thomas and this recent Capper case that you folks had, wherein the court struck down the death penalty in Brooks' case. I was the trial counsel in Brooks' case, and I sat there and listened to the charge that was read by the court to the jury in that case. In that case, I think there's a clear case of State versus Thomas violation where the court actually told the jury that, in my recollection at least, and I know our recollections all disagree as to what the court actually said in that case. And I don't really remember, and I was able to tell everybody that. But I rely upon the transcript, and silly me. In this case, the language in this case, if you find the state failed to prove that the offense was done while the defendant was committing or attempting to commit aggravated robbery or burglary or kidnapping or rape, but the offense was nevertheless purposely caused, or if you are unable to agree. So the court, maybe when looking, as Brooks has told us and Thomas has told us, to look at the whole charge, maybe in looking at the whole charge, we can correct it there. I don't know. I mean, truthfully, when I look at it, and I told Mrs. Green on the way down here this morning that when I really looked at this last night, first of all, my first look at this a year ago said this is obviously a Thomas violation. But it's somewhere in between, and I just don't know how I can get courts, or other lawyers can get courts, to just fill in the blanks in Thomas, and it makes it all very, very easy. But this is kind of a hybrid, I think, again, somewhere in between, that this court is going to be asked now to decipher. to say if that is sufficient for the purposes of this trial. The next issue is in issue number, proposition law number 8. And this was not objected to at trial, nor do I believe was it was brought forth in the Court of Appeals. So this is straight up clear that we think we bring to the court's attention. Basically, there were three series of what we call hearsay statements admitted during the course of the trial. The first one came from the victim's son, who testified that his mother had called him on a couple of occasions, indicating fear of the defendant, basically. That he had been to her house, that he had been over there at midnight, that he wanted to paint the basement again after he'd already painted it. This happened over a course of 2 or 3 days. The victim's son indicated to her that he would talk to the family. She asked him, in fact, would you talk to his mother, see if he could stop to do this. The next thing is, she's on her way to the doctor with a woman by the name of Norma Hulbert, a good friend of hers, I believe, that this is on the day of her death, and that the victim told Norma that the defendant had jumped out of the bushes or words to that effect, scared her one time, and that she didn't like him and didn't want him bothering her anymore. And then when she got to the doctor's office, apparently one of the nurse practitioners there, one of the doctor's assistants asked her, why is your blood pressure so high? And she said, it's because of this neighborhood boy that I'm afraid of. I'm very anxious about him coming over. And then there's a notation that was admitted during the trial from the doctor's records, was saying that anxious about a young neighbor boy, the words that affect all those things were admitted during the course of the trial. There was no objection to any of those things, and that I don't believe it was brought forward to the Court of Appeals. What bothers Ms. Green and myself about these statements is that the state obviously says that it is a then-existing mental, emotional, physical condition that is an exception to the hearsay rule. And obviously that is an exception to the hearsay rule, if that is in fact that. What bothers us about these statements is that the state relied upon State versus Simcoe and another state cited, another case cited, Simcoe-Ahanovich, decisions of this court. And I don't know how to explain away the Simcoe case. I've read it 2 or 3 times, other than this court says in 1994 that statements like these, right, just like these, are 80.801 exceptions as statements of present sense of presence, a present sense of mind, and so forth. But then this court goes on to say, 4 paragraphs later, assuming arguendo, that the testimony should not have been allowed. So, and then it goes on to say that this was a 3-judge panel.
Your best authority for this is Ahanovich, because clearly in Ahanovich we said that those extracurricular or extra judicial statements made, if they don't fall into an exception under the hearsay rule, obviously they're error. The question is it plain error? Does it rise to the level of changing this? With regard to that she was scared, though, that comes in under 8033, doesn't it?
I think so, sir.
Okay. Then my question is, who handled this case on appeal?
Two other active lawyers.
The reason I ask is because you seem to be talking about ineffective assistance of trial counsel, but with regard to the instruction that you just went over a few minutes ago, that wasn't even raised as an assignment of error in the Court of Appeals. So are you arguing appellate ineffective assistance of counsel as well? Did anybody do anything right in this case?
As you know, Judge, as you have said before, nobody's entitled to a perfect trial, and I don't think you got one here. But in terms of the Ahanovich business, I think Ahanovich, in addition to that, makes that hearsay admissible. But what bothered me about it is the delegation of the fear to this defendant, and I think Ahanovich would also indicate that that it's admissible that she was anxious, she was scared. But when the statement comes in saying she was scared because the defendant, I think that's the distinction I would like to make here, and that's what we brought into this trial. That not only the statement that she was anxious, but she was anxious because of what the defendant did, and he's then left kind of out in the woods here with no way of cross-examining that statement.
Well, but to make any sense out of 8033, you'd have to give a reason for the fear, wouldn't you? I mean, otherwise, in a vacuum, you just say she was scared. The next question is, why was she frightened?
Well, that's
otherwise nothing comes in.
Your Honor, that's obviously the argument, and that's what I would say is inadmissible about that statement. Mm-hmm. I would probably have no problem with it if it were just that she was scared. In terms of your question regarding the ineffective appellate counsel, some of these things I'm sure will be brought out in a post-conviction proceeding.
Are you assuming an affirmance?
No. I know that there's one pending. Now we seem to be doing these things side by side because of the new statute in terms of what's happening. I know that the post-conviction was filed, I think it was heard last week in some kind of conflict. So anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that maybe you're right. Maybe we should be arguing on this court. I don't do that unless I think it's extremely egregious.
No, I didn't say you should be arguing that. I didn't say counsel was ineffective. What I said was that there wasn't any objection, maybe because the first instruction, the acquittal instruction, was the hybrid you explained, and it was correct.
Okay. Is that true? Okay.
Counsel, I'd like to hear something about mitigation, since you opened by indicating that's the way this case should have been viewed by competent counsel and prepared for.
Here, I'll get to that here. I think I will jump to that here. The last, one of the last things I wanted to discuss was, first of all, I'll try to incorporate that into the proposition of law 12, which has to do with the court's opinion in terms of imposing death in this case. Number one, a couple of weird things really happened here. After the mitigation, the court set the case for sentencing, actually filed the sentencing order before the hearing. Now, I've been told by judges that I didn't make a lot of sense when I argued, or I felt sometimes that I shouldn't argue. But that's like the municipal court judge stamping all the preliminary hearing tickets in the morning. I mean, that's what happened in this case. You look at the timestamp. The hearing. I don't know what that says. I don't know what that says about what happened in this case. But the mitigation, basically, and while I'm on that subject, you read the trial judge's opinion, particularly on page 7 of that opinion. What the court does is go through the mitigation, and basically, and I'll give the court the benefit of the doubt, saying, when the court finds that these things weren't mitigating, what the court means is that they weren't of any substance in terms of the mitigating factors. But the court reads most of the mitigating factors and then says, this, and basically on page 7 starts, this offense was committed for economic gain. I don't know what that has to do with capital murder. And it is clear the defendant planned the offense. That has nothing to do with capital murder. Brought to the scene of the crime, articles which he included to be helpful in his plan, brought a tentpole, rope. He had difficulty in killing, this is in the sentencing for killing Loretta Foster, and it's clear he used different methods, strangulation. The defendant, and then the court goes on in the next paragraph to talk about after the killing, gave no support for the mitigation. He apparently made an attempt to clean the blood from the floor near Mrs. Foster's body. He said, reporting the sheriff after claiming to leave town. In conclusion, the murder of Loretta Mae Foster was brutally committed by the defense. Now, none of these things, I think, have to do with and that's the old argument of the facts and circumstances of the case in mitigation. I mean, when we talk about the facts and circumstances of the aggravating factors, During the first phase of the trial, or are we talking about the facts and circumstances as they relate to mitigation? And what this court does, I think, jump to a number of non-aggravating factors that aren't to be brought. I mean, the court could very easily have said, now the state says that the court is talking about mitigation when it talks about this, because the previous paragraph, they talk about mitigation. I don't think that's true. I think fair reading of this opinion indicates that these two paragraphs have nothing to do with mitigation. They're actually what the court felt about this case. And it's obvious. And those are really non-aggravating factors. They're not factors that the court ought to consider. Well, certainly, this was a jury trial, but what the court ought to consider its opinion. In terms of mitigation, they offered evidence, obviously, of the defendant's youth. I think 27, they offered testimony from a psychologist. They offered witnesses, family members, and so forth, regarding his boyhood. He put on a clinical toxicologist to talk about the level of alcohol and how that affects. So there was mitigation, I guess, is the answer to your question. It looks like there was mitigation in this case offered in the second case. There was evidence, as I have mentioned. I don't know how that fits into what I'm saying in the beginning of the trial. I don't know how that all would fit in had someone had the opportunity to sit down for more than a couple of weeks to think.
Well, counsel, what I'm trying to drag out of you is we have independent review, and I'm wondering, should this guy go to the chair or not? So what I'm trying to get out of you are what are the redeeming circumstances about his life that say he shouldn't move the chair?
Just that he had been, according to his family, a good person. He had a serious alcohol problem that was long-standing in his life. That on this night, as in many of his nights, he had been drunk, hanging around with these kids. I think that basically would be obviously the facts and circumstances of the murder itself are very brutal, very, very inherently gruesome.
He had a service record?
Yes, he'd been in the service in the Marines for some years.
History of trouble in his with law?
Nothing major. Nothing major. And a supportive family, supportive people in his family. His brother was either the state called his brother at the mitigation hearing to rebut some of the things that he had put on at mitigation. But very supportive of his brother, his younger brother, 20-year-old brother. Those are the kinds of things we're about to take in the second thing.
Thank you, Mr. Whitney. Mr. Bogdanoff.
Hey, please, of course, my name is Phil Bogdanoff. I represent the state of Ohio. Regarding the independent weighing of the aggravated circumstances and mitigating factors, this case is a very brutal murder. An elderly woman raised her family in this home. She lived only 3 doors away from the defendant's house. The defendant broke into her home. He came prepared in camouflage clothing. He had a weapon tenfold and he broke the fire up. He robbed her. She struggled. She tried to call the police. He pulled the phone out of the wall so she could not contact the police. She tied her up. While she was still alive, the coroner testified that based upon his analysis of the body, that when he tied her up, she was still living. And then he choked her and killed her. And prior to
counsel, we've gotten the facts down, but what I'm interested in is the defense counsel's argument that 2 weeks of preparation for capital murder is something that, as best I understand his argument, the trial court should not have allowed in its discretion that. This was inadequate preparation. The trial court should have, on its own, apparently, even continued the trial. What do you answer to?
First, I think one of the admissions that was made by counsel before this court is that he has examined the record, and defense counsel cannot find any prejudice. And I think the test set forth by this court is that it must show that counsel violated essential duty to his client. Further, there must be prejudice. There's nothing in the record to indicate any prejudice in this case. Number two, prior to counsel being appointed, the trial court spoke to the other counsel in the case, asked them if there was any hesitations or problems with appointing Kerry O'Brien as new counsel. And George Pappas indicated he did not have any problems with that, that they could proceed to trial. The trial court also asked the defendant himself whether or not he had any hesitation about proceeding to trial with new counsel. And the defendant indicated on the record that he wanted to proceed. Number three, Kerry O'Brien is probably the most experienced, or one of the most experienced, trial counsel in Summit County. And I believe that if any counsel could prepare for trial within 2 weeks, or actually 3 weeks before the case proceeded, 1 week with the jury selection, Mr. O'Brien could do that. Further, he had the help of co-counsel in this case. In State v. Lyle, this court indicated that trial counsel was not ineffective when he had 9 days to prepare for trial. In that case, there was only one counsel. Here, you have two counsel. So I believe that when this court reviews its previous cases and looking at the unique facts and circumstances of this case, you will find that the defendant did not have ineffective assistance of the counsel, that Mr. O'Brien was effective in this case, and the record supports that. And I believe that when counsel comes up here and says, I've reviewed the record and I cannot see any prejudice in this case, I think that this should control the court's decision on the first proposition of law. Regarding the independent weighing of the aggravating and mitigating circumstances, the statement in the case was a very brutal murder, and there were four aggravating circumstances. When you look at the mitigating evidence, the only mitigating evidence was that the defendant was a habitual drunkard. And the fact of the matter is, although he was a habitual drunkard, there was evidence that the defendant had a very supportive family who tried desperately to give the defendant the help he needed. There are many people who have drug problems or alcohol problems who have nobody. This person had a family to support, had a house to live in, and the evidence was that this defendant could live in that house as long as he did not bring any beer into the house. He had to stop drinking. The family was trying to help him. And the defendant, even though he had a supportive family, still drank. And in this case, it indicated that he tried on numerous occasions to get into Mrs. Foster's home. And this was a well-thought-out crime. This was not the spur of the moment person getting drunk and killing somebody.
Well, you wouldn't have a capital case at all if you had that. Yeah, that's not a very good argument in terms of whether or not the chairs.
Well, the argument that I'm trying to make this court is that the defendant is arguing he was drunk. And there was evidence that he was not drunk at the time he committed his offense. There was some thought preparation that went into this crime.
Counsel, because you've gotten to this with more time, I'd like to explore a little more fully. Murder is a heinous crime. Some involve yes, some are more instantaneous and some more drawn out, as this victim was focused on. But this weighing process, if this defendant doesn't, his life doesn't represent some things that might get taken fairly seriously in terms of mitigation, who would? I mean, he's got a military service record. He's not really been in any serious problems with the law. So what I'm wondering is this weighing process meaningful at all? If the crime is dastardly, isn't it just automatic chair case?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it's an automatic chair case. I think you have to weigh the fact that there were four aggravating circumstances in the case.
You charged them all.
That is correct. And he was found guilty of all. And I think the fact that there were four separate ones.
Single murder, but you charged him four times.
No, you have one murder and four circumstances that aggravate the circumstances of the murder. So you have four...
Does that comport with Jenks?
Yes, it does, Your Honor, because there were four separate incidents in this case, four separate actions of the defendant. He broke into her house, which is a aggravated circumstance by itself. He kidnapped her, that's an aggravated circumstance by itself. He robbed her, that's an aggravated circumstance by herself. He attempted to rape her, that's an aggravated circumstance by itself. So you have four aggravated circumstances against the mitigating evidence. And I think under Jenks, you can look, the fact that four is better than there just one with regard to whether or not this person should get the death penalty. I believe that is in fact a problem. But when you look at his background, the point that I'm trying to show is that yes, it's like...
He's got more to offer in mitigation than most that you see in death penalty cases.
The only thing I would disagree on that, in many of the death cases that have been before this court, the person starts out from ground zero. And I think this was even Antonio Brooks. I hate to bring that case up, but I remember reading in that case that this person never had a chance because his mother was a drug addict and he never had an opportunity himself. And I think that was some of the discussion during oral arguments with his court. This person had an opportunity. He had a supportive family. He had somebody to help him with his alcoholism. There are many people before this court that do not have that chance, do not have that supportive family. So when you're looking at this mitigating evidence of this person being an habitual drunk, I think you also have to look at the state's or the other evidence that there was a supportive family to try to help this person. So I think that counterbalances the fact this person may not have the worst record in the world, where he might have been out of character from him, in that he did have help. And there are an awful lot of cases before this court where nobody tries to help the defendant. And nobody ever tried to help the defendant in those other cases for their entire life. Here you have a person who did have some support, who did have somebody trying to help him. Did have somebody trying to...
You have a person who served... How long in the service? How many years?
We have 6 years in the service, but I do remember the father testifying that when he was in the service, he was also drunk. He would call home from the service, and his father could tell because he was drunk off in the service. So I believe that there was drinking while he was in the service. I do not recall what type of discharge he got or what was honorable or dishonorable. I'm just saying your father did testify to that. So I think when you look at the mitigating evidence, there are factors in that mitigating evidence which simply do not mitigate. Moving to the second assignment of error, which has to deal with the motion to suppress, the defense counsel indicated that the state placing a brief in the assertion of the fact that the door was locked. I read my brief, I cannot find that. I don't believe there was any evidence of whether or not the defense bedroom door was locked or not. I think the key issue in this case is whether or not the father could go into the son's bedroom. And the testimony was uncontradicted in this point that the father did state to the police that he had complete and total access to every room in that house. So if the father could go into the defendant's bedroom, then he could properly consent for the police to search in that son's bedroom. And that's what he did in this case. He told the police, yes, go ahead and search. So therefore, because he had complete control over his house, he could in fact tell the police to search the house, and therefore the consent from the father was in fact valid under the case law that's been set forth by this court and from the United States Supreme Court.
If the son was, if the defendant here had been paying rent and had been current in his rent here, I guess he was behind or hadn't paid, would that make a difference?
I don't believe so, but Mr. Whitney indicates that there was testimony of his paying rent. I don't recall that. The only testimony I recall coming from the police is that the father said he was not paying rent. Whether or not he was paying rent in the past, I don't recall that testimony. But I think the important thing is that when the police asked the father, is he paying rent, and he said no, that also gives them the go-ahead to search. But I think the main point would be that he says he has total access to the room. and there was no indication that the door was locked, but there was a separate box on the bedroom door. That would be another factor that could indicate he had some type of, the defendant had some type of control over the bedroom, that there were separate locks that only the defendant had the key to. But there's simply no evidence of that. The only testimony you have before you is the father had complete access to the son's bedroom and could in fact consent to the son's bedroom. A search of the son's bedroom. Regarding the seventh proposition of law on the acquittal first argument, the state has read that jury instruction by the court, and in there, the court indicates that, or if you are unable to agree to the state through these elements, that sentence indicates they do not have to acquit first before going to a lesser included offense. I would also point out to the court that this assignment of error or proposition of law was not raised in the Court of Appeals, and there was no objection to this jury instruction at the trial level. Therefore, I would also argue that the defendant has waived this issue on appeal by not raising it in the lower courts. In his eighth proposition of law, the defendant contends that the trial court abuses discretion by admitting the victim's statements that she feared the defendant. Again, I would indicate to this court that the defendant did not raise this issue at the trial level and did not raise this issue in the Court of Appeals. In State v. Simcoe and State v. Popanovich, this court indicated that the state can show the mental state of the victim. And here, that was the evidence that the state provided. The defendant, or the victim, Sarah Foster, stated to many people that she was afraid of the defendant. So the fact that she feared the defendant is in fact admissible under Evidentiary Rule 803.3. And therefore, it was properly admitted.
Before you leave that one, it's pretty clear, at least it's arguable, that's admissible under the exception 803.3. What about all those other additional statements that came in that you'd have to stretch? In fact, you couldn't stretch it that far to get them in under one of the exceptions, could you? And you know they weren't objected to.
That's correct, Your Honor. I admit it's a stretch.
Okay,
this
that's
court,
good. Thank you.
This court Simcoe made that stretch, and I guess I would ask the court to follow the Simcoe case because there's the same stretch there. I'd also indicate that considering all the evidence in this case, harmless error. Moving to the 12th assignment of error, the defendant complains about the trial court's opinion, where he discusses the circumstances of the case. And the defendant alleges that the trial court discussion is in fact discussing non-statutory aggravating circumstances. And I disagree. When you look at the trial court's opinion, the trial court goes through all of the mitigating factors, every single one of them that's listed in the statute. Even though they're not relevant, the trial just goes through them. And finally, he goes through the catch-all of any other factors. And when he's discussing any other factors, he's looking at the circumstances of this crime, trying to determine, is there anything that mitigates the defendant's conduct in the circumstances of the crime? And then he discusses all the circumstances. The fact that this crime was committed for economic gain, the fact that the defendant planned this crime, he brought camouflage clothing, and upon reviewing all of those facts and circumstances, the trial court concludes, even though I've searched for anything mitigating in the facts and circumstances of this crime, I simply cannot find any mitigating factors here. The trial court does not use these factors as aggravating circumstances. He looked for mitigation and finding none. Also, the trial court did, in fact, examine the alcoholism that was presented by the defendant and simply did not find it persuasive. So I believe that when you look at the trial court's opinion, the trial court did what was supposed to do under the statute and concluded that the aggravating circumstances outweighed the mitigating factors. However, Your Honor, the last argument that was raised by counsel has to do with the court's filing the sentencing order prior to the allocution by the defendant. There's no question that, in essence, the trial judge jumped the gun in this case. He shouldn't have done it. But the question is, was the defendant prejudiced by this error? The Court of Appeals looked at, the Ninth District Court of Appeals looked at that decision very closely. And what they indicated is that the statute requires the defendant or the trial judge to file the sentencing opinion in the clerk's office in the Court of Appeals. And in this case, the opinion was filed, but it was filed in the trial court's clerk's office. And for those not familiar with Summit County, we have two clerk's offices. We have one for the trial judge and one for the Ninth District Court of Appeals, and they're actually in two different buildings. So that the opinion was not filed in the Court of Appeals, it was only filed in the trial clerk's office. And therefore, the trial judge did not violate the statute by filing it prematurely. Therefore, the trial judge could have modified his opinion if it found something in the allocution by the defendant that changed the court's mind that the defendant should not receive the death sentence. There are very few things the defendant can say that would change the court's mind with regard to the death sentence. All of the evidence was already before the court. He had heard the trial, he had heard the mitigation phase, everything was already before the court. When I think of allocution, the only reason I would think of that a trial judge would not render the death penalty based upon something the defendant said would be if it was a female defendant and she was pregnant. At that point in time, if she indicates that she's pregnant, there is a reason not to sentence the defendant to death because of the unborn child. But absent that, there are very few, if any, reasons for the trial judge to change his mind regarding his decision on the death penalty. In this case, there was not any new evidence presented before the trial court to change the court's mind. And if there was any evidence presented to the trial judge, he could have modified his decision. Therefore, I do not believe that the court's jumping the gun, so to speak, on the finding of the entry was in fact prejudicial error. Although he did improperly file the opinion before hearing the defendant speak, I do not believe it was prejudicial error. I think when this court independently weighs the aggravating circumstances and mitigating factors, you will find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors. As I've indicated before, I'm not going to reemphasize this point. There was nothing done by the victim to cause her death. She was merely sitting in her home. There were four aggravating circumstances in the case. I think when you weigh mitigating factors, you will decide that death is, in fact, an appropriate penalty in this case. If the court has any questions, I would be happy to answer them. I would rely on my brief regarding other propositions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Bogdanoff. Mr. Whitney, you've saved about 2.5 minutes of your time.
Couple things, Your Honor, if I may. The only reason why, Your Honor, that I brought forth the issue regarding the timestamping of the order, I think that goes to what Chief Justice questioned to me during my portion of the argument was, I guess sometimes maybe we look to this court for those kinds of things that have to do with the integrity of the system, is what I'm saying.
Isn't that just another example here that of something that happened in this case that somehow reduces as you have said many times, reduces the integrity of what went on here, fairness of what went on here. That's just maybe in my mind just another example of a judge filing an order sentencing this fellow to death before he's even heard about him regarding or from his lawyers. I mean, that's just another example. If you look at his opinion, the trial judge's opinion, nowhere does he talk about in flight immediately thereafter about the aggravated circumstance that was alleged. He mentions the word aggravated circumstances, but nowhere does he outline what that means. So I guess what I'm saying is I think that that's just, in my mind, at least evidence of what happened here. In that regard, regarding the appointment of counsel, if you look at the opening statement and Mr. Green pointed out to me here, one thing we talked about, I forgot to mention in the court, it's virtually apologetic. And if you read the opening statement, it says, we're really sorry what happened to this lady. We're sorry that we're here. We're sorry that our defendant is brought up. I mean, it's just very, very apologetic. And I ask the court to look at that in terms of this assignment of error. And in terms of the second assignment here regarding the search of the defendant's room, he was outside, the point that I probably missed here when I was arguing, he was outside in the cruiser. Why, if they had these questions, didn't they just open up the door or send somebody out there to ask him about whether or not he had access to that room or whether or not there was any common authority over the room? And finally, Your Honor, Justice Douglas has some questions of me regarding this Aponovich case. And I had made a note here that even in Aponovich, it states, when it talks about United States versus Cohen, an example of the federal rule, it says, however, the court also observed that the state of mind exception, this is speaking of the federal rule, does not permit witnesses to relate any to the declarant's statement as to why he held a particular state of mind. According to witnesses, we're allowed to offer testimony that Cohen said, I'm scared, but not I'm scared because Gavin was threatened. That's the point that I was trying to make. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Whitney. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.